Hey, I apologize, too. I feel like I keep looking out my window. There's someone who's clearly been sent by a rival podcast, maybe the Nova Scotia Archaeology Podcast, but I think actually they're painting my building. And so this, as we were talking, this cherry picker, this human, just appeared in my window. But the...
New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, or just a little bit longer than a fortnight this time, I think, by Ken Holyoke, who is sitting, I think, Ken, you're at the longest hallway in North America, in Lethbridge, Alberta?
I am. I'm in the longest hallway. I keep forgetting to look up if it's still the longest hallway or not. It's I'm not entirely clear if it is, but at one time, it was. And recently, this longest hallway was... making its way into the coulee,
but
they've moved everybody's books beyond the cantilevered part, and so everybody has renovated their offices, moved their books to the other side of their offices, and so
river, now it's falling away from the coulee.
Yeah, the river should not be getting closer to me anymore.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Was it the far northeast 3,000 BP to contact that finally was threatening to push it all the way into the coulee?
So I got a green check mark on my office. I was not in violation of the in part because this bookshelf here, which is the closest one to the wall, is actually right underneath the beam that you can't be on the other side of. I don't think my plants and my Kachina dolls are taking up a whole lot of weight on the other side.
No, probably not. Even the one that's loaded with cocaine that came back in the 70s. As I mentioned, this is the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and we've got a very exciting program coming up for our listener here. But we're going to talk about coastal erosion. But one of the things that the listener might have just noticed when we introduced this was that it's still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, isn't it?
It is, and in fact, Gabe, it has been called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast now for 50 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is that in fortnights, Ken?
What is that in fortnights? Oh, geez. Well, so actually, we figured out it was 2 years. So we started in January 2023. So 26 fortnights, right?
Pretty good.
Is that right?
I mean, it's probably a little screwy
it'd be 52 fortnights.
And so the lucky listener can figure out how many fortnights we've been...
somebody should try to figure this out. Have we somehow managed through, like, the weeks that we don't hit the fortnight, and, you know, we've taken a month off, I think, in August the last couple of years, that we've managed to nail somehow averaging out to hitting a fortnightly distribution over the last 2 years?
You know what I actually think we should do? We shouldn't encourage anyone to do that. We should just encourage them to believe that.
I think that's probably the easiest thing to do. And Emmanuel, I think that's... fireworks and like horns and things should be going off right now. I meant to actually bring in one of those one of those things.
The vuvuzelas, yes.
No, that's for a soccer game.
With the thing that sticks
whistle
out
as you, and it like yeah. I can't remember what they're called, but anyway,
yes,
I couldn't find one at the house this morning, so
oh, that's too bad. The kids must have taken it.
Yeah, and I don't know if the microphone would pick it up. Remember we had that, we were trying to play it on the xylophone one time and it wouldn't work.
Yeah, we have had that problem, but so Ken, here we are. I would say at this point as a podcast we've matured. Would you agree with that?
I think the sonic journey has matured. Whether we as people, you and I as Ken and Gabe, have matured. I suspect the prize read from the last episode would point to a lack of maturity, actually, among the co-hosts.
But even though we now are, Ken, I think we're the oldest podcast about New Brunswick archaeology at this point.
That might have been achieved 52 fortnights ago, but yes, I'll take that.
But Ken, as we've matured, we've also expanded the scope of this podcast. Would you know what I mean? Like we're not really just about New Brunswick archaeology anymore, are we?
No, we're not actually.
And so, Ken, we also though are we've got listeners all over the world, if their VPNs are to be believed.
That is true.
And so one of the things I think that we can be confident is that this worldly cosmopolitan crowd very likely has a name that they think would be better for this podcast than the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, don't you think?
That is entirely possible, yes. That would that is, I think, well within reason.
Yeah, and we would never just steal that name from them, because we really think about this as being that we've entered into a contract with the listener. It's kind of a moral code we have with the listener.
Yep, the social contract, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. But listener, if you did send in a new name for this podcast, we've got a pretty exciting prize for you. And so, Ken, I mentioned that our typical listener might not just be brilliant and handsome and interesting. They might also be very sort of cosmopolitan. They might have big ideas about the world. And so, Ken, are you at all distressed by the current geopolitical scene?
Is anybody not? I suspect our listenership... I think we probably have a Venn diagram that is just a darkened circle of listeners who would be concerned about the geopolitical situation and interested in a podcast about New Brunswick archaeology.
Well, so are there any particular aspects, though, Ken, of humanity that inspire you amid these troubled times?
So I was actually thinking about this today. They set up a piano in the hallway. There's a wing that I walk through that is basically just a glassed-in hallway with a bunch of plants in it. It's quite lovely, you know, to see these tropical plants growing. Uh-huh. They set up a piano there, and the students here at University of Lethbridge, many of them are incredibly talented and are always mm-hmm. playing sort of beautiful piano music and sometimes singing with it when I come down that hallway. And I think that's a very good sign of humanity.
Yeah, I think that's great. And Ken, one of the things I think that we know is that many different cultures have music, right? And that's a point we're going to return to here momentarily. But I think, Ken, you and I would both agree that a little more cross-cultural understanding would go a long way toward healing some of the rifts in the world around us, don't you think?
I think that's very fair.
Yeah, and so we're going to start off with a little exercise here in cross-cultural understanding for our audience, just to get everyone set up for this prize right here. So, listener, you might know this, but Ken is a Canadian. And Ken, what do you think is the most quintessentially Canadian song?
Oh, geez. I'll say the first thing that came to mind, Acadian Driftwood.
Yeah, okay, so Acadian Driftwood by the band. The war was over, but their spirits were broken. And so, American listener, if
spirits
if you...
weren't broken.
Oh. So American listener, you can hum that as a kind of soundtrack during this prize read. And if you don't remember that one, you can just hum The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. It's sort of the same song, really. Or the other option is that you can hum That Don't Impress Me Much by Shania Twain. All valid options for this exercise.
That is very Canadian. Yep.
Okay. Yep. So are you humming, listener? I'm going to give you a minute. Okay. All right. And then for the Canadian listener, what we're going to have you do is go to your stereo. I'm going to give you a second to do that here. Okay, so you're at your stereo, and you're going to want to fire up Apple Music or Tidal or Qobuz or whatever you use. Alternatively, if you have an extensive vinyl selection, I'm going to have you navigate over to the S section of that. And you're going to, while you're there, you're going to grab the iconic album by Mr. Bruce Springsteen, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And once you're going to get that, you're going to set it on your turntable, and you're going to drop the needle right there on track numero uno, and you're going to return your receiver to 9 for... And you're just going to need to play that while we do this prize read, okay? Okay, so everyone's set up. And so Ken, it's no secret that Canada is my adopted home. I came here as an economic refugee and found myself welcomed. And not just because, as Harry Truman, the former American president, said, Canada is a broad land, broad in mind, broad and physical expanse, and I heard broad physical expanse, and I thought, I'm going to fit right in here. And Ken, I think that you, like our listeners, have also heard that these are somewhat interesting times between the two, let's say, nuclear powers that share the longest so-called undefended border in the world. Although I think, Ken, you might question that undefended characterization based on the time we tried to cross over it with just a hair over your Courvoisier duty-free limit. But I think we can all agree that, like former Clinton said, quote, ours is the most remarkable relationship. The prime minister said, whether we like it or not. Or, as the late Pierre Trudeau said, living next to you is in some ways like sleeping with an elephant. No matter how friendly and even-tempered the beast, if I can call it that, one is affected by every twitch, and grunt. And look, Ken, these were both men who knew a thing or two about sleeping next to things. So look, these problems of international diplomacy, they aren't new, but that doesn't make them any less urgent. And these tensions also affect archaeology. Ken, we both had to contend with what the archaeologist David Sanger, himself quite an international man, termed an intellectual fault line, cutting between Maine and New Brunswick and making it challenging to integrate archaeological research from either side of the border. And that's really the ethos that's driving the first annual McDonald Washington Symposium on Canadian-American and American-Canadian understanding. Named for a man so drunk he thought becoming an Anglican would fix it, and a man so committed to liberty he owned 123 people, this three-day summit will act like an ESAF, Canadian-American friendship party, but for international diplomacy.
Excellent.
And we know that the listener to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast is exactly the sort of person capable of bringing policy insight to make sure that international relations don't just persist, but flourish. And that's why we've got a ticket for the lucky listener who renames this very podcast to attend that symposium. So, Ken, the way this symposium works is that along with a number of prominent diplomats, have summoned a number of notable Canadian-Americans and American-Canadians, such as Tommy Chong, Dan Aykroyd, Alanis Morissette, and Ted Cruz, to chair a series of roundtable discussions that promise both to enlighten and advance our civic discourse. And the way we're going to do this, Ken, is that we're going to have a series of breakout sessions organized around a specific topic. So each one is going to be organized around one of these topics, and it's going to be chaired by one of the notable CANAMs or ANCAMs. And I have a few of the roundtable topics here. Ken, if you'll let me bring up the program. All right, so here's some of the topics. You ready for this? Okay.
Did you say CANAMs and AMCANs?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that does work. Okay. Sorry.
All right. You ready for these topics?
I am. Yep.
Okay. Is Pierre Poilievre just Donald Trump with bigger hands and a smaller nuclear arsenal?
What are you? Non-existent nuclear arsenal, actually.
Exactly. What are you looking at? What to do when your O's are feeling lonely? Canadian rules baseball, an idea whose time has come? Is the world ready for 30.1752 meter or 99-foot base paths? Raised diphthongs, great for a vowel sound but bad for underwear, or vice versa? Aerosolized cheese, Cheez-Its with flavor, and Flamin' Hot Cheetos. Is Canada losing its place in snack food supremacy?
I don't think we were ever there.
That might be true. What is the point of Ohio, anyway? Kids in the Hall. Oh, was it a whimsical comedy or an active shooter drill? Fracking and open pit oil extraction, the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Black Friday, an opportunity to come together at the mall. And ready, set, go, whose nuclear subs can get to the Arctic first? Pew pew! And that's just some of what's going to be on offer here, Ken, at this symposium. And not only that, Ken, I think you know that the NB ArcPod would never send the lucky listener off to something that would just tickle their mind and not their taste buds. So while discussing these topics, we've got the finest in CAN-AM fusion for our attendees. From sausage, gravy, and Caesars for breakfast, to pepperoni rolls paired with all-dressed chips for lunch, to donairs and the other kind of donairs for dinner, all followed up with a Nanaimo bar and a Marlboro cigarette for dessert.
And
McDonald Washington...
And your own jar of Tums as you come through the door.
The McDonald Washington Symposium is as gastronomical as it is diplomatic. So, Ken, I think we can all agree that just like Joe Biden recently said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. So, lucky listener, grab your hammer. We're sending you to Niagara Falls for this impressive summit. And, Ken, where would the lucky listener send this week's winning entry to rename this podcast and be in the driver's seat for North American diplomacy?
That would be newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ArchaeOlogy. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And listener, you may have picked up that Gabe is not teaching this semester with the complexity of that prize read.
It's a little less medical than yours, Ken, but that's all right. So, Ken, if you turn to that very Canadianly spelled New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast email address, what's in our mailbag?
We've got an email from Saqib. Nope, this is definitely spam. Professional digital marketer and SEO expert, though. He's been following our YouTube channel and fascinated by our content. An email from Michael, the Monopoly chair. Dear Ken,
oh,
and
nice.
In the prologue to the current Phenomena episode, Ken mentioned having a chair in Studio 598 that, per family lore, came from the originator of the game Monopoly. I suspect that would be Charles Darrow, who created the commercial version of the game and sold it to the Parker Brothers Company. If you don't know the further backstory of Monopoly, though, you might find it of interest, and its origins are surprisingly subversive. A game invented in 1903 by an anti-monopolist woman named Lizzie Maggie. This game, called the Landlord's Game, eventually ended up in Darrow's hands, and the rest is history in a complicated way. The NPR podcast and radio show Throughline did a very interesting dive into this a couple years ago, which I highly recommend if you are interested. The title is The Story of Monopoly and American Capitalism, and he provides us with the link to that.
Oh, wow. Thank you. We'll probably try to throw that in the show notes.
Yeah, I think we will. Thank you, Michael. And he says, thank you for your continued good work, continuing to enjoy every episode. All the best from Central Vermont.
Well, thanks very much,
from Michael.
Appreciate that. Creamy season will be here before we know it.
Dave, DWB, writes, big retouched flake, eh? Hi, Ken and Gabe. First, I thank you for another season of your scintillating archaeology podcast and wish you and yours
the
best for the coming new year. Second, I just listened to your episode featuring my friend and colleague and former student, David Milley. It was great to hear more about David's current research, the Eastern Archaic, Poverty Point, Remote Sensing, and Phenomenology. David's enthusiasm for archaeology and his willingness to take on cutting-edge work is an inspiration to us all. Finally, I am intrigued by the email that you received from Trish, and I'd be very interested to see the photo she sent you. From Ken's description, the artifact that Trish found sounds like a large, marginally retouched, use-worn flake of the sort sometimes associated with the terminal archaic. Intertidal assemblages in my monograph on such assemblages, I illustrated a terminal archaic projectile point found in the same area at the intertidal zone offshore from the blockhouse in St. Andrews. Parenthetically, several decades ago, an assemblage, maybe a cache, of large terminal archaic groundstone tools was found at the mouth of Pottery Creek, just a couple hundred meters from the blockhouse. Looking forward to the next episode. Best regards, Dave.
Excellent. That's the, I think he's referring to the Davis did that, was it Rowan Island? Is that what it's called? Is that what he's talking about?
Yes, maybe.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for the email, Dave. And we'll forward that flake to you to have a look.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't remember. I will admit that was far enough away ago. It was early. I feel like we have not recorded for a long time.
We've been going frontward and backward in some very strange ways.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Taylor writes, the title, Potential Future Episode Idea. I've been listening to the podcast for just under a year now, but have recently been catching up on a bunch of episodes.
Well, I wanted
to share how amazing it's been as a student to hear from people in so many different positions in the field, and even across disciplines, their research, and even little tips like what to keep in your field bag, which is especially helpful since I am attending Gabe's field school this summer, which will be my first one. There you go.
Looking forward to that, Taylor.
It is inspiring to hear about all the potential avenues that archaeology can take you down, which gets me even more excited about my degree and dreaming about where I may end up. I also wanted to make a suggestion for a potential future site episode or episodes, if you haven't discussed them already. I grew up in Fredericton and always hear about the excavations happening in Marysville and at Officer's Square, but never heard back about whether anything was found at either place. Especially since now I am studying archaeology here, I was curious if anything came of the projects, and if so, whether results were ever investigated or communicated. Best, Taylor. Well, Taylor, so both of those projects, I believe, were started by consultants and excavated by the province eventually. And so one of the things we could do is reach out to the province to see if they have any updated information about it. I know Officer Square might be a little bit less easy to talk about, in part because they're... I was not living in Fredericton when it started, but there was considerable controversy around that project.
Although I know at one point one of the sets of consultants was giving a public presentation about it, so we could reach out to them and see if they might come in and talk shop about that.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. When did that happen?
What is time, Ken?
What is time? Yeah.
But I definitely saw an online presentation on Officer Square. So we'll see what we can do, Taylor.
Yeah, both of those things are actually of interest to both of us. The site in Marysville, as far as we understand, is purported to be quite early, so probably a Paleo-Indian site. But there's a short technical report that I've seen, but nothing else at this point. So,
and I can actually, Taylor, if you bother me at school, I can try to track down the technical report for you and pass that along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for writing in, Taylor. Yeah. Thanks for catching up to the show.
I think that's it. We've got our usual smattering of things that are just spam. We also good news, and this is probably a good thing. This is on auto renewal because I had no idea that we were supposed to renew it. But our Apple podcasting program has been renewed. So
good.
We will continue to be distributed by Apple.
Yes, and under what name are we currently distributed by Apple, Ken?
the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
And if the listener can, we're navigating over to Apple right now. There, I think there's a series of symbols there. Am I right that there would be five stars in front of them?
Yes, yes. So you want to mosey on over and drop a five-star review on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast and help our SEO. And in particular, maybe separate us from the search results that come around us.
Exactly.
Write reviews that say, these guys are not like Jordan Peterson, and you probably won't like Jordan Peterson if you are listening to that.
Right. I think that's important. I mean, like, I think the only way in which we are like Jordan Peterson, well, I mean, you're Canadian, so you're sort of like Jordan Peterson in that sense. And there's the all-beef diet, which we, of course, both subscribe to an all-beef diet. But the other thing is that we would like to have 1 million listeners.
Yes, that would be great. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it might be stressful, but it would be great.
And so the mailbag is complete, and you've read the prize read. But we have a legitimate prize that we are giving away as part of our 50th anniversary spectacular.
An IRL prize, if you will.
An IRL prize.
Let's just reiterate. That means, listener, if you're getting to this point and you win this prize draw, we will actually send you something.
Yes, yes. We are legitimately going to send you a prize. And we had hinted at it in the previous prize read in the last fortnight, but it is a copy of the handbook, Boudreaux's Typology of New England Projectile Points. Is that what the title is?
I believe so, yep.
Or a New England typology.
It's very hard to get in Canada.
Yes, which you can't get in Canada. So it will be purchased in America. It will be heavily tariffed. It will be carried across the border to be tariffed again or something. I don't know how that's going to work. But and then it will be mailed to you, dear listener. And so we were thinking that one of the things that we would do, same as last time, is if you want to send us an email to do an entry, if you want to post on our Instagram page or tag us in an Instagram post of you listening to the podcast, your names will all be entered in the draw, and I think we'll probably make the draw in the next fortnight. So we will advertise this on social media, but for those of you who are not on the socials, we welcome email entrances as well. And so just put in the title, 50th episode spectacular.
We'll also take, you know, a Polaroid taped to a bottle of Balvenie Scotch,
yep,
per
always.
Usual.
Yep.
Yep. One of our favorite ways to receive correspondence, in fact.
To either of our offices, hopefully graciously passed on by our mail services people.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I assume my mailbox won't hold a whole bottle of Balvenie Scotch, so it's just going to have to be, it'll just be sitting in the office.
A shade narrower than mine is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Ken, what is the deadline?
Well, let's say, oh wait, should we announce that on the next fortnight?
Should we say that it just needs to be in by the next episode?
Yeah, but entries will be cut off at the airing of the next episode, and then so in two fortnights you will get the prize will be read.
Yes, that's perfect. Yes.
Yeah.
Great. So get those prizes in, listener.
Yes. Or
those prize bids in.
Yes. So episode 51 will be the cutoff. Episode 52 yes. will be the prize announcement.
That's right.
Yeah.
We have the bingo spinner ready.
Exactly. As we head to the Century Club.
Yes. Is that what we're calling it?
There will be more party horns for the 100th episode spectacular.
Even party pronghorns, maybe.
Oh, there you go. Actually, I bet you they have some noisemakers here that I could, you know, those thunder sticks?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Go ahead and get some thunder sticks. We'll take a prize read written on a thunder stick too.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. But so Ken, we have an exciting episode coming up for the listener tonight. And it is, we've promised human environmental interactions, and listener, you're going to get human environmental interactions. It took us a little while to get here this season, but we're here now. And this episode is the first in what we believe will be a series of erosion episodes. So they may not be back to back, but we've got another erosion episode planned, and we're going to open up with Andrea Richardson, who's doing erosion work in Nova Scotia, and then we're going to be joined by Kate DeWater and Arthur Anderson, who's, of course, no stranger to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, talk about a paper that they recently did with me and Will Kaczynski about coastal erosion of archaeological sites in Maine. And if you're interested in particular in, we talk about kind of what to do about the erosion crisis. It's kind of a methodologically focused episode coming up.
Yeah, yeah. So you missed the opportunity, though, Gabe, to say that these episodes will be chronologically shingled.
Oh, they will. That's right. Well, stay tuned, listener, to know what that means.
Exactly. So we will talk to you after these interviews, listener, and nice to have you back.
It's nice to have you back, listener.
Yeah. Welcome to 2025. I think this is our first 2025 episode, isn't it?
I think we already dropped one in 2025.
Oh, but we recorded that in 2024.
I'm not sure again.
Okay, we are joined today by Andrea Richardson, who is the Climate Change Adaptation Coordinator for Nova Scotia, working with the Cape Sable Historical Society. Andrea has also worked in the CRM industry in Alberta and Nova Scotia. She has a combined BA in Anthropology and Geography from St. Mary's University and an MA from the University of Calgary in Archaeology, where her MA thesis looked at desertification and ceremonial architecture during the medieval warm period in sub-Saharan Africa, including a publication in the BAR International Series, Performance and Agency, the DGB Sites of Northern Cameroon. Her work with the Cape Sable Historical Society and the Nova Scotia government involves working with various stakeholders and Indigenous communities in the archaeology sector to implement the recently released climate change adaptation strategy. And lo and behold, that's what we have Andrea here to talk to us about. So welcome to the show, Andrea. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
And yeah, thanks for joining us, Andrea. And so we Ken mentioned that your work was on desertification, but there's nothing sweeter except maybe dessert than coastal archaeology. So we're glad to talk about that. But you're working with the Cape Sable Historical Society, which is linked with the Nova Scotia Museums on a big project, implementing the archaeology sector climate change adaptation strategy. And we wondered if we could start just with you telling us a little bit about that plan and how it came together.
Okay, sure. So back in 2019, the Nova Scotia Department of Environment and Climate Change partnered with the Department of Communities, Culture, Tourism, and Heritage and the archaeology sector through the CALP program, the Climate Adaptation Leadership Program, which is a federal funding program to develop capacity in climate adaptation. That partnership was meant to develop this climate adaptation strategy for Nova Scotia, for Nova Scotia's archaeology. So between 2019 and 2022, there were surveys sent out and various discussion groups and things, a lot of it online, because, of course, a lot of that ended up being during COVID. But between consulting or CRM archaeologists, academics, government, community organizations, First Nations communities, and Mi'kmaq rights holders. And then the strategy was finalized into a 44-page document in December of 2022. And that document was accompanied by a more technical document on the results of those surveys that were sent out. So then in 2023, new funding was announced through the provincial climate plan, through the provincial Department of Environment and Climate Change, for 2 years of funding for a climate adaptation coordinator to implement these various strategies. So archaeology isn't the only department that has this. With the Department of Agriculture, they partnered with the horticulture, Christmas tree, and cattle and sheep sectors, the Department of Natural Resources and Renewables with the electricity sector and coastal parks, and then the Department of Environment and Climate Change itself with the freshwater sector. So yeah, all these coordinators started in 2023 and started implementing our strategy. And the strategy itself is based on four outcomes, four things that we're trying to accomplish. That starts with using climate information so that by 2027, information about climate risks to archaeological sites and resources is widely available and effectively communicated to the archaeology sector. And this is used through all stages of archaeological process in Nova Scotia. For that, we started with updating the MARAI to include climate risks as part of the discussion. Sorry, the Maritime Archaeological Resources Inventory Forms and various other things. But yeah, so we started there. And then the second outcome is community stewardship, so that by 2030, the Nova Scotians are actively participating in the stewardship of archaeological resources that are highly likely to be impacted by climate change. And that works with the third outcome, which is collaborative governance. so that by 2030, the Nova Scotia archaeology sector is effectively coordinating, resourcing, and acting on sector adaptation efforts through sustained and committed partnerships and collaboration. And so both of those outcomes are based around this approach being a community-based approach. And then the final one is protection, which so that by 2030, important sites among the most vulnerable inventoried archaeological sites in Nova Scotia are protected from climate change.
And that would be like actual, like implementing like plans for physical protection, like gabion walls and that kind of stuff.
It is. It's a bit of a misnomer because there is no sort of permanent protection that you can put in place to defend an archaeological sites from climate change. But so it's around decision making on what sorts of protections we can put in place, what time limits we're looking at. So both some of that hard infrastructure, riprap and armor stone, which we're getting away from, but only lasts 30 to 40 years, but it does last 30 to 40 years. And then we have obviously limits on human and financial resources that are around that decision making.
Hey, I apologize too. I feel like I keep looking out my window. There's someone who's clearly been sent by a rival podcast, maybe the Nova Scotia Archaeology Podcast, but I think actually they're painting my building. And so this, as we were talking, this cherry picker, this human just appeared in my window. I apologize for that. It's great to hear those sort of spelled out in those criteria. And maybe after the show, we'll get you to send us some links to that information so we can share it with the listeners.
Yeah. And so it sounds like this is like a really kind of all hands on deck approach, and that it's, you know, it's measured, it's thinking kind of out into the future, that you guys have sort of long-term goals for where this is going to end up. And it sounds like you have an incredibly busy task and you're working with a whole group of coordinators. So how is it that Cape Sable Historical Society specifically became involved? Like it shows up, like when you look them up, they're an archives and genealogical center. And so is this just that it's part of the new Nova Scotia Museum system and you're placed there? Or is it that they're turning this facility into kind of changing its mandate, basically?
So the way this came about is that most of the coordinators are based in our professional organizations. So for example, the Christmas tree coordinator works for the Christmas Tree Council. And
wait, so there's something called the Christmas Tree Council?
There is. Christmas trees are a major business in Nova Scotia.
Well, so I knew that, but I can't in my head now. I'm just picturing about people sitting around like a round table with red hats on. And
it does feel like a setup for the sequel to the movie Hot Fuzz.
Yeah. It probably smells delightful in the Christmas Tree Council chambers.
They're actually looking a lot at the impact on climate change on various tree species. Nova Scotia doesn't have a professional association for archaeology. And the Nova Scotia Archaeology Society doesn't have capacity for an employee. So part of the reason Cape Sable Historical Society was chosen as the host organization is it does have some capacity for an employee. The society has been quite active with partnering with the Nova Scotia Museum on an archaeological excavation at Fort St. Louis. And there's an exhibit within the Barrington Museum complex on those excavations. It's an area of the province where climate change impacts, particularly from intense storms and from coastal erosion, are a big impact on the community. So the museum and the society have been active and interested there. So that's some of the reasons that Cape Sable was chosen for that.
Excellent.
Can you tell us a little bit about, the listeners can be somewhat familiar with this just from listening to things about archaeology, but what are the major threats from climate change to archaeological sites in Nova Scotia? And where are you seeing those effects most dramatically?
So the big one that always comes up when you're talking about climate change in Nova Scotia is coastal erosion. That's the one everyone talks about. And that is one of the major threats to archaeology. But in addition to coastal erosion, we have more effects from those more intense storms. We have the storm surges causing inundation. We have wind events blowing down trees, which affect context within archaeology sites. There is Nova Scotia in the last couple of years has had major, major rain events during the summer, which have caused widespread flooding in those major river systems, in particular going into the Bay of Fundy, the Shubenacadie and the Avon rivers with those soft, sandy banks. Sea level rise. So the southern part of the province in particular, relative sea level rise, because of course Nova Scotia is also sinking as sea level is rising. And so relative sea level rise, southern end of the province, close to Yarmouth, is somewhere around 1.8 meters over the next 100 years, wow, which is has a huge impact on infrastructure for sure and plans for that.
I feel like this is supposed to where we're cut in for a word from our sponsor about how we should all be buying gold. Is that how this works now, Ken?
Yeah. So, and then sea level rise itself has an impact on archaeology, not only speeding up erosion, but also just causing that inundation or tidal submergence, which as you know, working in coastal areas makes archaeology tricky. Mud doesn't go through screens well. Underwater sites have other technical issues. So yeah, and then there's other effects like we hadn't been thinking about too much in Nova Scotia until 2023, which are like large-scale wildfires and their impacts on archaeological resources.
So basically, like this, the scope of this is sort of, you know, like it's hard to kind of wrap your head around, right? And so there's no simple solutions. The challenge is huge. But you guys, so it sounds like you have kind of a plan for how to approach it. What are some of the practical things that you guys are doing so far? And what have you, like, are you actively out there excavating, identifying and excavating sites? What is sort of the on the ground work right now, basically? And what are the next steps over the next couple of years in the program?
So most of this year has been focused a lot on public education and outreach, but we've been developing climate change vulnerability model for archaeology sites in Nova Scotia. So one of the things that we're trying to get out and do is sort of verify that model and see how effective it is. One of the problems is that a lot of those sites were recorded back in the 1970s and 1980s. So our site locations aren't super great, right, which affects our modeling. So that's one of the things that we're working on. We are working on, this has also been one of our big focuses for this year, is trying to put together a citizen science type program with a community reporting form. So that would enable community members to be engaged with us, as well as with the provincial government who records archaeological sites in Nova Scotia, in terms of what changes locals are seeing to archaeological sites that are important to them. So for the last year, we've been developing this form, more or less have it in its final version now. So we're in the process of launching it as a citizen science program, or at least launching it to enough that we get some feedback on whether it's going to work.
Can I give the website for that here, Andrew? Would that be helpful?
So our website is at www.nsa-cca.com.ca should get you there.
I like this idea of the citizen science program, but you kind of mentioned two things that I think are related. So one of them is the education piece. And so how are you guys approaching that education piece? Is it community meetings? Is it just sort of like basic identification of archaeological resources, or is it all sorts of different things?
It's quite a few different things that we're having our conceptualization, at least. So far, it has been a lot of going out to various communities and giving talks, trying to develop workshops for communities to identify archaeological sites. We are working on trying to develop some curriculum-related information to give schools. In particular, grade 5 is when archaeology is part of the curriculum. Coincidentally, also climate change, so that's useful. And so that's what it's been so far. We are also next month hosting a climate cafe to get sort of professionals and others engaged in the archaeological sector talking about the effects of climate change, but also where do we go from here?
That's excellent.
And that one's particularly complicated. You go into the cafe and they give you an iced coffee that's filled to the brim and then slowly warm it. So one of the things that you've kind of alluded to, like in that answer, is that this information is important for people in general, that knowing about climate change is important for the public, and that archaeology is kind of a tool to do that. And that's also been a bit of a through line in your career. You've been studying climate change adaptation, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, where you've looked at climate adaptations during the medieval warm period. And are there lessons from history and the archaeological record that the public should take and should learn and apply today?
Sure. I mean, archaeologists, as you know, we study climate change in general, and we study those humid adaptations to climate change. Obviously, what's going on now is happening at a much faster pace than most of the climate change impacts that we studied in the past. But we can definitely apply some of those adaptation efforts. Also, just having that capacity to sort of understand some of that climate change data is useful in terms of trying to communicate those changes to the public, I think.
And sort of put it into context, basically, so yeah. People are seeing this happening around them, and it's, you know, engaging various different communities, whether it's resident communities or indigenous communities, about what's important to them, I think is important. But I also think it's interesting, too, that this education piece has the opportunity to kind of contextualize that this isn't the first time this has happened in the past, but this is, I think you made a point that this is happening much faster. And so our responses here have to be basically different. Like, we have lessons that we can learn from the past, but this needs to be done. The pace has to change, right? And I think we can probably all agree that all of this stuff probably should have happened like 50 years ago when they were talking about climate change in the 1970s.
Or in the Industrial Revolution, right before the Industrial Revolution. Thought through some of the... So Andrew, we're mindful of your time, but we wondered if there was just anything you could kind of leave the listener with. I mean, if you could tell us a little bit about next steps in the program, or about what folks in Nova Scotia could do to be involved, or anything like that.
Yes, our big next step is getting that community reporting form launched and getting out into communities and getting people using it. So telling us what's happening in various parts. The archaeology sector in Nova Scotia is quite small and also quite centralized. We tend to be in and around Halifax Regional Municipality. It's hard to grasp what's going on in some of those other areas. Also, as in most of Canada, most archaeology in Nova Scotia is cultural resource management. And so you don't get to choose where you go looking for impact. So yeah, that's our biggest thing that we're trying to get launched. I am doing field work as well. I meant to mention that before. Going out to sites that some community members have highlighted in terms of sites that they're concerned about. So yeah, just continuing with that. We're hoping to do a little bit of a post-fire survey down along the Clyde River.
Thank you so much for sharing that work with us, Andrew. We're excited to see it develop and excited to see the community engaged work that you all are doing continue and expand.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think that hopefully in hearing this, maybe we can catch a few listeners in Halifax that might be able to join that citizen science program and help out with the big task that you're taking on, but a really important one. Well, and thanks for coming on.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much, Andrea. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, Ken, tonight we're joined by Katie DeWater, who is a marine sciences student at the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine, where she's a researcher in Dr. Will Kaczynski's Coastal Research Lab, and where she is also the coordination and administration lead in the Aquarium Science and Conservation Lab. I'm told that at UND that's called a fish kid, but we'll loop back on that. Her research in that lab is on the impact of climate change and sea level rise on coastal ecosystems and archaeological sites in Maine. She recently received a Goldwater Scholarship to support her studies. Although much of her research has been on salt marshes, she recently was the lead author on the paper Evaluating Quaddy Region Archaeological Site Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Erosion through the Integration of Geographic Information Systems Modeling and Surveys, which is forthcoming in the Journal of North American Archaeologists and is most of what we're going to talk about this evening.
It's actually out.
It is. It's in press. It hasn't been assigned, I don't think, a volume number.
Oh,
so it's on a first view.
Oh, maybe that's why it won't load up on the page here. That's what I was trying to do. I've got it on my tablet, but it won't open through my library, so.
Oh, well, If the University of Lethbridge librarians are listening right now, we could use an emergency intervention on getting that to load. But we're not just joined by Katie tonight. We're also joined by Arthur Anderson, who is no stranger to listeners of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. He's an associate teaching professor at the University of New England. His PhD is from Durham University. His work focuses on coastal archaeology, lithic technology, and better understanding indigenous and European contact in the Northeast. His publications have appeared in such venues as the Journal of Island and Coastal Archaeology, Archaeology of Eastern North America, and Advances in Archaeological Practice, and of course, most recently also in North American Archaeologists, because he is among the co-authors, along with me and Will Kaczynski, on the article we're going to be discussing today. So thank you both very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you, Katie and Arthur.
Yeah, thanks.
So I thought maybe just kind of where we could start is by sort of summarizing the paper and what we did. And this is what I like to ask all of my co-authors, is to just tell us what we read about it. And I'm reminded of the old Martin Amis line about that it used to be when he was younger, what he wanted to do was sit down with a glass of wine and a good read of himself. But now with co-authors, I like to do that with you all, with my co-authors. But so fundamentally, we considered the effects of sea level rise on 10 archaeological sites in Maine's Quadi region. And then we compared these to site audit data and compared those to sea level modeling. But so before we get to the modeling, Arthur, could you describe the data set that we used kind of on the ground and the questions that we had about it that we then went on to compare to the sea level rise monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of, I'd say, good data, depressing data, but I think it was good data, about the level of destruction when it comes to archaeological sites in Maine's Quadi region. And that had been, you know, sort of five-ish years of myself and Gabe and assorted others tromping around the woods, occasionally getting yelled at, briefly falling into the ocean, etc., trying to track down locations that had been recorded at wildly varying levels of accuracy over the course of the last pretty much 100 years. So we had
The varying levels of accuracy, Arthur, might have been because it wasn't us that fell into the ocean, it was the GPS we dropped.
I was going to ask, was this one of the journeys where the this high-precision instrument went floating in the Gulf of Maine?
It did, yes. I tripped, to be fair, and dropped it. So I thought maybe we could just begin by summarizing the paper and what we did. So fundamentally, we considered the effects of sea level rise on 10 archaeological sites in Maine's Quadi region. And then we compared those site audit data. So we compared those sites that we had visited to the sea level modeling. And so before we get to the modeling part of our discussion, which will take up the bulk of our discussion, Arthur, could you just describe the data set of sites that we visited and what the questions we had about it were that Katie then answered?
Yeah, we had a pretty good data set, I think, though a depressing one, of sites we had tried to visit. And that was the result of Northeast Archaeological Survey work, which has really been myself and Gabe and assorted others running around the Quadi region with varying levels of success at preserving ourselves and our gear and finding sites. There, you know, we had good data from the State Historic Preservation Commission that gave site locations recorded at wildly varying levels of precision over the last 100 years or so. So trying to track those down was occasionally uncertain, but in at least a lot of cases, it was pretty clear we were at the spot they were talking about, and it was pretty clear that there wasn't a site there anymore. Or there were, you know, heavily damaged remains. So we had some good on the ground, which was, I think, something of a rarity. We've been able to correct some site locations and confirm a lot of site destruction. I think when you have a good data set like that, there's always a question of how you scale that up and starting to think about big data. And particularly as this is a pressing issue, starting to think about, you know, what we can do from our universities and our computers to try to better understand this when field time can be at sort of a premium. And frankly, that's where I was lucky enough to have Katie in the class as I was going on and on about the work we were doing in coastal erosion. And Katie was doing a lot of GIS work. She came up with the idea to work through some modeling and try to start exploring that. So yeah, we started with a really good on the ground, sort of ground truth data set of Maine Historic Preservation Commission information. And then a GIS specialist came along that could help us sort of bounce that off some models and see what we had there, which I think.
Great. So we had 10 sites that we'd visited in person. And then, so Katie, can you tell us what you did with those sites? I was going to say to those sites, but that had already happened. So it's with those sites.
Yeah. So Arthur got me the coordinates that you collected in the field, of those sites, and I pulled those into QGIS, which is the software that we use to make our maps and do our modeling in. And so then I pulled a raster digital elevation model from NOAA and the U.S. Geological Survey, which is really just a collection of pixels with elevation values tied to them. And then I generated...
Raster is the is tech speak for image file.
Yes.
That's
Is this where I say raster? I hardly know it. Thank you for laughing, Katie. I'm going to ask Arthur to give you an A+ on the whatever course you're in right now.
But yeah, after we got our raster, we generated a buffer, a 5-meter buffer around each site coordinate to give us a kind of like theoretical. And then every 4 years, the Maine Climate Council puts out predicted sea levels, a low 2050 and a high 2050. And they do the same for 2100, but that's kind of far away right now. So we used the low 2050 sea level predictions and the high 2050. Sea level predictions, kind of thinking that sea level is going to be somewhere in that range that they predict. And then based on the current record water level, the highest water level ever recorded here in Maine, and the highest storm surge, we add that to the low 2050 predictions and the high 2050 predictions. And then we find in QGIS where sites are above those lines and where sites are below. And then we kind of measure how much of the site is remaining after each scenario occurs.
So one of the take-home points of this is that the models for the current sea level rise seem to underrepresent the amount of erosion that's occurring at coastal sites. And some of this is tied to, in the paper you talk about, basically some of it has to do with, you think might be probably conservative sea level rise numbers, but also what Arthur was talking about, there's sort of this variable accuracy when it comes to site locations, but you've also picked up that it works for some sites, but not for others. So can you tell us a little bit about why that might be?
Yeah, so we did bathtub models, kind of assuming that the sea level rises, it's going to be like turning on a faucet in a bathtub. But what we don't account for is wave run-up, which depends a lot on the height of the waves, the wave speed, and then the slope near the site. So if it's a really shallow slope and you have tall, fast waves, there's going to be a lot of wave run-up, which will push the erosion further landward than we would account for. But if sites are on a steeper cliff side, obviously they're not going to be as impacted by the wave run-up. And so incorporating that into models would make them more accurate. Yeah, and then we also have the site accuracy piece where the sites weren't collected to be used for GIS analysis. We kind of did that. Thought of that after the site locations were recorded. So
did you want to riff on that a little bit, Arthur, about the sort of site location accuracy piece? Because I think that's a really interesting part of this. And I think it's particularly an interesting part because I think many cultural resource managers would like to think that we could sort of just sit at a desk. This is great. We've got a nice data set in front of us. And so we'll use a computer and we'll figure out what sites are threatened.
That was one of the really interesting kind of trains of thought that came out of this paper. And I think was also a good example. I mean, this started out as Katie's final essay for one of my courses. And it was really exciting to bring more people into it and add more data and expand this a little bit. And that kind of idea of the nature of a lot of archaeological site data and how it does or doesn't work, I think really came out further as we expanded this and was one of the things that kind of went above and beyond what we were like, we thought we were looking for. So it was kind of the exciting find and I think bringing the paper to fruition. And, but of course, it's one of those things that seems really obvious in retrospect, which is that a site is not a point. And we had a great data set when it comes to making a map or finding the location. But it's not a great data set when it comes to modeling what's going to look like and what's going to be underwater in 2065, because it's fundamentally a point. So I think that was, yeah, I think that's one of the sort of valuable takeaways. A site's not a point, and we need to think about things like extent and topography to really model some of this stuff well, and we don't have a great way to do that from the majority of existing site data.
Yeah,
and so should we talk a little bit about accuracy and precision really quick, too, just so that way Will Kaczynski will feel a disturbance in the forest. And,
yeah, Katie can best channel Will here.
Yeah, I mean, being precise is really important for the models. If the point was 1 meter a little too close to the ocean than the site really is, that can completely skew our results. And I think another interesting variable that could be added to this is the site depth. So how deep into the soil that the archaeological site really is. because then we can model a site volume that's left behind, because sites aren't just a 2D circle on a screen. So
yeah, there's
that might be the new that might be the name of the show, Ken, by the way. So we could flag sites are not just
sites
a 2D circle.
Sites are not a 2D circle, and that's very true. Although from a regulatory standpoint, in many cases they are. You guys have kind of posited sort of an interesting challenge here from both like a regulatory and a planning perspective, in the sense that like we have this challenge where, like Arthur said, that sites are not a dot on the map. You have an existing data set that you've kind of run a predictive model on that sort of works but doesn't work. Do you get a sense that you now have a better idea of what needs to go into a more refined model to more accurately predict these things? Because it's challenging to think about, you know, volume without going out and excavating a site. If a site's just recorded, that's challenging. Katie, you mentioned a bunch of different factors like slope near the site and how waves are coming in. This seems like it's to kind of get this to the point where it's actually, you might be able to use it in a broader sense reliably. There's like, this seems like very big machine predictive modeling. And do you get a sense that that's doable, or are you confident that the results of this actually suggest that it works well enough that it should be something that can be paid attention to and can be rolled out more like across like a wider area than just sort of a small area in like Cobbs Cook Bay?
I'll give Katie a minute to think about that and jump in with something that I think one of the, getting back to some of the issues that, or the question David posed before, one of the challenges of the data set is that, you know, as we say, Will remind us about the difference between accuracy and precision. And those were both wildly variable in the existing data set. Sometimes the point given was incredibly precise, but it wasn't accurate to where the site was. Other times the point given was entirely accurate, but it kind of referred to that whole side of the cove. So that already created sort of rumples in the data that were difficult to iron out. So that was one big challenge in a way that I had not totally been used to thinking about data quality personally.
And I think if I could cut in for a minute, Arthur, that one of the interesting experiences we've had recently was we kind of went through a bunch of the site data from, I guess, the 90 and the 80 blocks in Washington County with Art Spies, the state archaeologist in Maine, and kind of looked at those data and then kind of compared the sort of descriptions of sites that were in the site records and then the dots, right? The way in which the dots were sometimes put on maps in order to be really a tool to find the site again, rather than a tool to model the site, right? So, yeah. And we've even got an experience where one of the dots is clearly just to indicate that a whole island contains a bunch of sites, right? And so we were sort of like, well, what is this extra dot? It's sort of near the middle of the island. This is really interesting. And it's like, oh, it means the whole island has tons of archaeological sites, right? And that's obviously really useful from a I want to go out and find the site's point of view. It's not very useful for what Katie is trying to do.
Yeah. Like we were out, we found a site this past, or a couple of sites this past summer on an island that has a number of sites all on, like registered archaeological sites along the south shore of the island. And they're buffered by a 200 meter buffer, which is sort of the standard in New Brunswick, right? So a pre-contact site gets this 200 meter buffer around it. But the buffers have these overlap points.
And that's 85 yards for the American listener.
There's these overlap points that are at, you know, sort of the outer rim of these two buffer zones. And so does it get sorted into the site to the left or to the right? Because it's inside. And you know, and if the buffers overlap, are they actually just, you know, do you call this two different sites, or is this, should this be mapped out as a contiguous archaeological deposit, right? So
that's where the QGIS model just blows up.
Yeah.
Smoke just starts billowing from the screen.
But so Katie, I think to you, it's the shift.
It erodes
from points,
twice, Ken.
Pardon me?
It erodes twice.
It erodes twice, yes. It's double bad.
Exactly.
So it's the shift from points to polygons. And how does that look in QGIS, and how does that model out?
Ken, could you phrase that as a question for the guests?
So we talked about how you, so the model kind of breaks down because of this precision issue with like point data. But if you shift to polygon data, so if you're looking more at a kind of broader landscape perspective, do you get a sense that the modeling that you used would probably more accurately predict where you have erosion at these particular locations, like where you'd mentioned all these other features that you have to take into consideration. You're modeling over a polygon area, so like a larger area than just the dot. Does that capture some of that nuance that, you know, until you're standing right at the site and be able to say, oh, well, there's this slip over here and the waves seem to crash in that direction and wipe off that area to the, you know, 5 meters to the left of this buffer of this little dot. Does that seem to play out, or did you guys even test that?
We didn't test that, but I think it would be much more useful looking at each individual site on its own, predict how the sea levels will impact it. Even if we don't add in wave run up to that, having where the site actually is will be incredibly useful rather than this magical theoretical 5 meter buffer that we used. But I think regionally, the models will be very useful even without the wave run up at identifying patterns along like the entire main coastline or the entire Nova Scotia coastline, just as they are.
And I'm this is more of a curiosity question. You might not be able to answer it, but will you factor in things like historic aerial imagery to see, for example, to map out what these shorelines looked like as they changed over time? And is that something that, and maybe you know sort of like theoretically within a modeling context that can actually change the output at the other end. But do you guys do any of that in this, like in this study, or is this something that's planned down the road?
We don't do that in this study, but I think that would be very useful down the road in making our models more accurate, especially for specific locations and not just a broad regional view of how these sites are impacted.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So Katie, one of the things, so I this isn't on the list of questions, so I apologize, but the most recent University of New England alumni magazine had you in it, and a lot of your work is actually apparently on salt marshes.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, the way in which a salt marsh is sort of interacts with sea level rise is very different from the way an archaeological site interacts with sea level rise. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And so one of the things I kind of wondered about this, though, is as a salt marsh that you're sort of modeling the way these salt marshes act, could you like elaborate a little bit just on the way that the bathtub model you describe applies to salt marshes but not to archaeological sites?
Yeah, so the bathtub model with the salt marshes, it just shows like the marshes filling up with water, and the marshes have a lot of elevation changes in them that are based on the rivers that run through them. And so bathtub models can be useful there. It's also important to calculate wave run up on the marshes too. But just for general sea level predictions, bathtub models work well for the marshes. And I think the biggest difference between the salt marshes and the archaeological sites is that they have the potential to accrete, and they do that naturally with the sediment coming in. So they have the potential to naturally build up as the sea level rises. And there's an equilibrium point that can shift. If the sea levels are rising too fast, then the marshes can't keep up. But unfortunately, the archaeological sites can't do that. So,
interesting.
I'm also envisioning a whole new archaic period project here that could arise, you know, like looking at like Seabrook and how, you know, the Seabrook Marsh grow in what way over time. Yeah. That's cool.
Interesting.
Neat.
And the difference, I remember, Gabe, this was a big thing. Difference between a salt marsh, a fen, and a bog I remember this was a big debate in Port Jolly, how to classify what this small wet area was.
I don't so much remember it as being a debate, Ken, so much as Konrad Gievsky telling us we were wrong.
Right, okay.
Like it was, I think we just didn't know. and then he did, yeah. So, who I think is at the University of Ottawa. I don't know if he was Will's professor.
I have no idea.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
This is referencing a conversation we had before we started the recording, listener. So that's.
Okay. So I guess one of the sort of take home points here, though, is what are the take home points? So what are some lessons that archaeologists learn from this paper?
One of the things that I think is interesting about it, the idea that a site is not a point, and so we can do these sort of theoretical algorithmic ways of making a site in a point into a polygon for purposes of this type of modeling, but it doesn't always work that well. So what do? You go out there and you get the GPS and you make a polygon and you determine site extent, which is the ideal way to do it. But why not dig a test pit while you're there? like we've got to get back out to the sites in order to get the data to do the modeling was, I think, my biggest takeaway.
Out of the bathtub into the field. And Katie, what do you think were some of the take-home points from this work, sort of from the other perspective?
I mean, a take-home for me, like, what really got me into this project was asking if there's a way to prioritize sites in some way and to determine which ones are more at risk than others. And kind of what we saw from the results of the models is that they're all at risk and that they're all vulnerable, and some maybe more than others, but we couldn't really determine that from our models. But yeah, getting back out there in the field is incredibly important, not only to collect better GIS data that can be more useful and generating more accurate models, but also because these sites aren't going to last very much longer.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. And so what are the next directions for this research? I asked it as a leading question, knowing that, you know, I know some of what Arthur's working on. I know some of what Katie's working on.
And what you're working on them too. And too, Gabe.
Right. Yeah. So this has been a strange interview because I was a co-author on this paper, and I'm not quite sure how to do that.
So how about I ask Gabe and Katie and Arthur, what is the next direction in this research? And I'm interested in applications too, like beyond. So what are you guys going to be working on next? And do you get a sense that this can be applied? Is this something that you hope other people are going to reach out to you and maybe apply elsewhere? Like, or do you get a sense that this is, everybody is kind of grappling with different ways to approach this coastal erosion issue. And the main message seems to be in every one of these papers that, good Lord, we are like 10 years behind where we should be, kind of thing.
Well, Ken, I thought you'd never ask, but one of the things we're working on actually is we're applying some of the stuff Katie's doing to a bigger, two bigger data sets. So one is to a large set of survey data from Maine, into a large set of survey data from Nova Scotia. And so we're comparing those two data sets to one another, but we're also considering the way in which Katie's models can apply to the ground truthing that we've done with those data sets.
Excellent.
And somewhat unfortunately, the take-home point from that paper, which we hope will be coming out soon, is that all of the archaeological sites, as Katie said, are basically in really bad shape, all the way from the South Shore, all really, really rough, but that some of the information that we can use from that is that we should probably focus a lot of prioritization on salvage. And so going and looking really, really closely at what few sites remain, especially in unique geological circumstances that have helped protect them.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think that message of just, it's bad everywhere, if anything worse than we've thought, is a powerful one that comes out of this and really crunching the numbers, because I think there's been sort of a generation of papers that have said it looks bad, and now better data and better modeling is revealing how bad
it is. Bad.
So I think that's been really big.
I think one of the horrifying realities of reading through this paper was recognizing that 2050 is actually not that far away.
Like, we'll be around dealing with 2050.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
Well, Katie will.
I hope so.
But it. Yeah. But one of the other things about that was that, so Katie did some modeling on the like the 2100, but so Katie's 2100 modeling included the sort of numbers that are like 71% of all sites in some regions will just be obliterated.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, Katie, when what are some of your like future research directions? Oh yeah, yeah, with this, and then I'll ask you in a minute about your other stuff.
Yeah, so like you said, we applied the models to the broader range from Nova Scotia to Maine, trying to identify the regional patterns of how the sites could be impacted by sea level rise, and we broadly found that it's pretty much bad all around. And a big hope that I have with the results of this is that it can be used to write grants to get funding so that we can go out to the sites, do the salvaging that needs to be done without showing that, you know, these sites aren't going to be here. Who's going to like fund projects to go do this stuff? So there's a need to be out there.
Awesome. Yeah. So just really highlighting that we're kind of at the salvage stage, not really at the survey stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Ken, did you have any more questions about the the project?
No, I keep trying to think of a way to frame something to end on a more positive note, but
I think I have a positive note.
Okay, well, I was going to say the positive note that I was going to go out on is that this is really important research, and I think continues to highlight the importance of the region that we're all working in as case studies in kind of a global challenge, right? And the work that you guys are doing is exemplary and a great kind of a great case study in that. So, but Gabe, if you have something positive out of the work, then let's go with that too.
Well, no, my highlight was just going to be that because this is the second time that we've had an undergraduate on the program who publishes like a postdoc. And so I thought we would ask Katie what her plans are for next year.
Yeah, so Katie, I meant to say at the start of the program was I read through the paper and then I was looking you up and I was like, oh my goodness, she's an undergraduate student. And this is like just fantastic work. Like this is really incredible. So so as Gabe said, I'm excited to hear what your plans are.
And Emmanuel, if she says anything other than archaeological site modeling, we'll cut that out and change it.
Yeah. You can just do the voiceover. Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, so next year I applied to UMiami and to URI. I applied directly to PhD programs, hoping to skip the master's. But I would be studying oceanography and more changing coastal processes due to climate change. So sediment erosion, coastal erosion, salt marshes, potentially coral reefs, but I know wherever I end up, I'll be using GIS. That's my main focus and my main passion is using GIS.
So wait, did people live and make archaeological sites on coral reefs?
Apparently.
That's right, listener. You heard it here first. Katie's going to find Atlantis.
If you have any interest in freshwater estuaries, I'll give you a buzz here sometime in the next few months.
Great.
But no, serious, all kidding aside, Katie, that's great. And congratulations on, I think this is your second paper?
No, this is my first paper. I have another one in review.
This is your first
paper? The March paper's in review.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Okay, cool. Well, congratulations. That's very exciting. And we're looking forward to seeing where your career goes with all of this. And hopefully a little bit more archaeology work, even if it's a side hustle.
I hope so. This is great.
Caught by your spam filter as we keep sending you questions.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, Arthur, as her impact factor rises in bibliometrics, our impact factor rises in bibliometrics.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's just hope that she doesn't throw the midden out with the bath model water.
Yeah. Everything's all gone to shell, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Katie. Thank you very much, Arthur. We really appreciate you coming on to talk about this recent paper. And just again, that's evaluating quite a region archaeological site vulnerability to sea level rise and erosion through the integration of geographic information system modeling and surveys. And that's going to be out in North American Archaeologist. Well, it is available online right now, but it'll be out officially, I guess, first issue of this year, I guess.
Yep. And Katie, it was great to meet you. Thanks for coming on, Arthur. Always great to see you. Thanks for coming on again. And Katie, keep your eye on the mail.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
And well, Ken, I think it's time for hit pieces. I think we're staying coastal for our hit piece today.
We are staying coastal and actually coastal erosion even theme.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So this is a new paper from Bonnie Newsom, Rebecca Cole Will, and Catherine Schmidt. So Bonnie is an associate professor at the University of Maine Orno, and are they called associates of the Climate Change Institute?
I should know because I am one. I think they're research associates
or external faculty research associate in the Climate Change
faculty
Institute.
Faculty associates.
Rebecca Cole Will is an interdisciplinary chief of resource management at Acadia National Park in Bar Harbor, Maine. And Catherine Schmidt is a science communication specialist at Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. Did I pronounce that correctly?
I think so. And the astute listener will actually recognize this author list because it is not the first time they've been in our hit pieces.
Yeah. And so there is a Mi'kmaq term at the start here. Malyamugzik, Malyapudumik. It takes care of us, so we take care of it. Indigenous Heritage Stewardship at Acadia National Park, Maine. And this is in the Journal of Field Archaeology, just came out this week. Volume 50, issue 1, pages 95 to 105. So you can see that in the show notes. And so this is basically an article building on, so we talked in the fall about an article that came out where Bonnie and the team were discussing the field school that they had had with students, some experiential learning opportunities. And this one is getting a little bit more into the theory behind what drove that forward and sort of the project, scaling out on the project as a whole. And so what it is focused on coastal shell-bearing site called the Fraser Point site in Acadia National Park. Shell heap site, it's been eroding out. David Sanger excavated there in the 1970s and 80s, and it's been managed by the National Park Service. University of Maine, I think, did some analysis on it throughout the 70s and 80s. And one of the things that this article highlights is finding ways to re-engage Wabanaki people in their heritage. And so this is a Wabanaki site, but in the past, Wabanaki people did not have access to those collections and didn't really have an opportunity to inform on the interpretations coming out of those sites. And so, you know, there's sort of a basic culture historical sequence that was built out of this, but not a whole lot of information was gleaned of, out of that other than just sort of building an inventory of another site in the area. And so Bonnie talks about kind of the various stages of the project where they have Wabanaki graduate students who basically reviewed the 1970s collections. And there's a language project where community members were sitting down and looking at artifacts and going through providing Wabanaki terminology in different Wabanaki languages for those stone tools and other other belongings from that collection. There was a two-eyed seeing session that community members participated in trying to find ways or thinking about ways that Western scientific approaches and Indigenous approaches and interpretations can be brought together to sort of better the final result out of the process. And then the field component, which yet we had talked about in a previous paper. And what's really interesting about this, and I think this is actually very helpful for a lot of researchers who are doing community-engaged archaeology work, and in particular in this region. And so this is something, for example, there's a list of recommendations in here that somebody like myself can talk to the communities who I'm working with and think about the research that you and I are doing, Gabe, and the research that colleagues of ours are doing, and seeing whether
and in fact,
not...
Ken, even before we came on the air here, you were saying that you've updated some aspects of a grant you're submitting very soon based on some of these recommendations.
Yeah, exactly. And what's great to see is that, you know, I've developed this grant application with the community collaborators that I'm working with. And so looking at the things that we are listing and the priorities that they view as important as part of the work that I'm proposing are the kinds of things that Bonnie and her team are recommending here. And so that's prioritizing Indigenous leadership and perspectives in archaeological work, whether it's site stewardship or decision-making, implementing two-eyed seeing approaches, incorporating Indigenous languages into archaeological analysis and interpretations, developing educational programs, establishing co-stewardship arrangements, creating and advocating for interpretive materials that accurately represent Indigenous histories, prioritizing the documentation and preservation of at-risk coastal sites, ensuring open access to archaeological collections and data for Indigenous researchers and community members, integrating climate change adaptation strategies into archaeological site management plans, advocating for policy changes, and investing the time and resources into developing long-term trust-based relationships between heritage site caretakers or archaeologists and Indigenous community members. And I think that you and I probably, we can think of a project, the Bailey Project that we're working on, we're really trying to hit a lot of these things. And so, but to other researchers who are thinking about how they want to frame research working with community members, this is going to be a really helpful piece to take with them.
Absolutely. So we commend that article to you, listener. And Ken, it's in Journal Field Archaeology, and maybe give the title again here.
Yeah, so Malia Mugzik, Malia Padumuk, and I probably butchered that. It takes care
Sorry,
of us.
Sorry, I realized it sounds like I was being cruel by asking you to repeat the title, but they...
It takes care of us, so we take care of it, Indigenous Heritage Stewardship at Acadia National Park. And yeah, and so the translation of the title is that it's a Mi'kmaq term, which translates to "it takes care of us, so we take care of it."
And that's excellent. Cool.
The idea is. And that's in Journal of Field Archaeology and just out in the last few days, actually.
Yeah, excellent. Congratulations to that research team. And actually, just one other thing, Ken, I don't know that there have been many papers from this part of the world in Journal of Field Archaeology.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I can't.
Just off the top of my head, I'm having...
That would be focused on like maritime or Wabanaki archaeology, so...
No, so very exciting.
Yeah, that is very exciting.
Cool. All right, listener. Well, Ken and I are looking forward to talking to you in about a fortnight, where who knows what order we will be recording this show in. Who even knows what the show will be about, listener? But the TARDIS is idling. Ken and I are about to step into it.
And we're looking at empty bottle of Courvoisier.
We sure are. Yep. But we're not driving the TARDIS after a half empty bottle of Courvoisier. Don't worry.
No. We've got a driver for that.
Yes. You do not want to time travel while half cut.
Or you do, as long as you're not at the wheel.
Yeah, exactly. All right, listener. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Bye, listener.